They don't sense their need of Christ until the cracks open in their lives, you know. When the cracks open, that's when the light can get in.
Sure.
So we need to continue to connect with them and continue to do all the gospel foundation stuff.
You're listening
to the Thinking Matters podcast.
Conversations
at the intersection of faith,
culture,
and reason.
I'm your host, Todd Funk, and today I'm honored to be joined by Lou Meyer. Lou, it's great to have you on the show today.
Thanks, it's great to be here, Todd.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know Lou, he wears a lot of hats. He's an elder at his church. He's a Bible teacher, an apologist, an evangelist. He leads a community chaplain initiative and an online course of evangelism. He's a visiting lecturer at Cap and Ray Bible School, lecturing on evangelism, apologetics, cults, religions, probably worldview, things like that. He served with the Open Air Campaigners Evangelist for 28 years now or so. And in the past, he's done youth work and youth camps and Scripture Union. He's got a BS in biochemistry and diploma in biblical studies. He's married and has three children. So, Lou, you're a busy man.
Yeah, thanks. I think it's actually more like 35 years now. So, a lot of people complain that I have a lot of BS, but I do have a BSc in biochemistry and some research experience, which is helpful in talking about the origin of life.
Yeah. Well, in the States, I've got a biology degree, and it's a BS in biology. So, what's a BSc?
Well, it just means Bachelor of Science.
Or science. And the C means what?
So the C is SC for science. Maybe different
countries. Oh, BSC. I see. Yeah, mine's just a BS.
Yeah.
I'm full of BS.
Okay. Then.
Well, so Lou, tell us first about your spiritual journey. When and how did you first become a Christian? How did you come to Christ?
I came to Christ in my childhood. My mum and dad were committed Christian people. My father hadn't really come from a Christian background, but he got converted in his teenage years, I believe. And so I was brought up in an evangelical Christian church, made a decision for Christ at the age of 7, and kind of confirmed that in my baptism at about 14 years of age.
Okay.
Sought to be a testimony at school. I remember I wrote my senior speech for the contest on the Bible and on Christianity, and I won the contest in the last year at high school. So, but I wasn't always as well behaved as I should have been. God's been very gracious to me. So I came to know Christ. Then I wanted to do medicine. I went to Massey University in Palmerston North to do just the sort of pre-med year. But I also got involved in an evangelist and outreach team, and I think that was probably indicative that I was to be a doctor for the soul rather than a doctor for the body.
Oh.
So following that on, I got invited to be a youth pastor after I'd left research and been to Bible school in Auckland. I got invited by the church I went to be a youth pastor there, and that wasn't exactly suitable to me. I'm not naturally a pastor type guy. I want to get out there and share the gospel. So, and then I spent three years with Scripture Union, and we were running camps. I think as an organization in New Zealand, we ran about 50 camps a year, and I spoke at various camps and spoke at school Christian groups. And then a little later on, I joined OAC Ministries as an evangelist. So I've been doing that for about 35 years or so. So I'm getting old.
Wow. Wow. But what do you do for relaxation? Do you have any hobbies, things outside of ministry that kind of helps you stay grounded and centered or enjoying life?
My wife and I do quite a bit in the garden. She's got a PhD in plant physiology, so she loves the garden, and I was brought up on a market garden, so I'm into veggies and stuff as well. I've got a boat. We go and catch snapper. I go hunting, but I haven't been for a while. Uh-huh. So I quite enjoy a bit of venison, but it's been a while since last time I went out, I saw nothing. So, but yeah, I enjoy hunting as well.
And where do you hunt? You're from Auckland region. Am I getting that right or no?
I live in Auckland. I've got a mate with some farms up on the Kaiapara Harbour. It's journeyman's hunting. In the old days, me and my mates would sometimes fly in through a block further down country on a helicopter, gentleman's hunting. And so I've got a few spots around the place.
All right. So you said you've been with OAC for over three decades.
I think I joined in 1990, so that's 35 years.
And do you see the results that you've seen in the past with open air preaching and campaigning and whatnot, or is that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Specifically, OAC has a particular style. We often use a sketchboard or have done in the past. And that's where you draw up some interesting stuff and you stand in front of it and you preach. And I do that from time to time. We use those things a lot with children's ministry as well, camps and things. But generally, our approach out in the open air, out on the streets, like tomorrow down at the Auckland CBD, we use a different technique. We put up a table. We have a sign at each end that says 2-minute survey for a chocolate bar. And so we offer them a chocolate bar for doing a 2-minute survey. And at the bottom of that, they tell us what religion or belief system they're at. And one of the reasons for that is because New Zealand society, and I think in Auckland, we're such a multi-ethnic culture now, you cannot assume an understanding of Christianity. So what we try to do is start where they're at in their thinking. And so if they put down I'm a Mormon, then we know exactly where their thinking is, and we can talk to them from that basis. And if they put down I'm a Hindu, well, we know where they're coming from. And I've done a whole list of resources, a series called Great News, Great News for Hindus, Great News for Jehovah's Witnesses, for Mormons, for Buddhists. There's 8 of them so far at the moment. And so we will, and it's expensive evangelism because the books are worth $2 or $3 each. Yeah. But we will give them one so that they can read that book and it'll help them understand their religion, because a lot of people don't understand their own religions, and it'll help them to understand why Christ is true and important. So we're doing that perhaps more so. I mean, people always like chocolate, and it changes we get it from reduced to clear, so it's cheaper. It changes the whole experience of relating to people in public. It's a fun thing, you know. I guarantee that our chocolate is non-fattening, which is nonsense, of course, but most people see the joke. Yeah. But just that you've given them something, you've shown some kindness, and that gives us a right to ask questions. And what we are noticing, I think, Todd, at the moment is there's lots of openness to talk about spiritual things out in the public domain. And of course, people from other ethnicities, they're not hung up on talking about spirituality. They just don't want to be forced into a commitment they're not ready to make.
Sure.
So I see it as a little bit like, if excuse me, itchy nose, if we have a look at the Bible, you know, in the city of Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, the Apostle Peter stands up and preaches. 3,000 people come to Christ. I mean, that's every evangelist's dream, isn't it?
Sure.
And then you look at the Apostle Paul a few years later in Athens, and he stands up and preaches the gospel. And a few people become followers of Paul and then followers of Christ. Now, so what's the difference? Was Peter a much better preacher? The difference is that in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, everybody had a belief system pretty much intact on which Jesus made sense. They knew there was a God. They knew they were sinners. Their history proved it again and again. And they were waiting for rescue. They were waiting for a Messiah. And when Peter preaches and explains the Messiah, the Holy Spirit's at work, then many come to Christ. Excuse me, Paul in Athens, he's got a situation way more like Auckland, way more like modern New Zealand today, particularly in the cities. He's got a whole lot of different belief systems floating around there in Athens. There are atheists, agnostics, there are pantheists. There are people who worship many gods. There were all sorts of philosophies. And so I believe that what he would have done was he would have taken that bunch of people that became his followers and started from the foundations of our belief system, which is creation and God, and then taught them through it. And when they got to the stage where Jesus made sense, some of them, of course, responded to the gospel and the church was born. And I think in New Zealand today we are, and in the Western world, we are way more like Athens than we are like it was on the day of Pentecost in Jerusalem. So the task of the evangelist or the faith sharer is to identify where people are at in their thinking and move them in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And success for us today really is not so much how many crowds come to our mission meeting and how many get saved. Success is moving a person one step in the right direction.
Sure. Yeah.
And maybe giving them some literature which helps them along that process. And that encourages a lot of Christians because they say, oh, I'll never let anybody to Christ. I must be a lousy faith sharer. Maybe I should give up. I say, no. Yeah, success is helping a person one, and it might be just showing a loving act. One step in the right direction is success. Of course, goofing it and pushing them in the wrong direction is failure. And sadly, but we get all sorts out there. We had a guy told us he reckoned he was a reincarnated pharaoh from ancient Egypt.
Were they serious?
And, well, I thought I'd ask his mummy. But I don't know if he would expect this or not. He must have been pretty bad in his last incarnation because he's a rough sleeper in the streets of Auckland. But but we get them all, eh? We get them all.
It sounds like it.
We get a lot of people who say, I believe in all religions. You know, I believe in every religion.
That sounds good, doesn't it?
Of course, it sounds good, but it's quite easy to refute, you know?
Yeah,
it's
logically incoherent, for sure. Well, I want to dig into a little bit about a book that you've written recently, Current Korean Cults. What inspired that, and what's the emphasis on Korean cults? I mean, can you tell me a little bit about that?
Okay, here it is here. And
thank you.
Folk can order it from, I wish I could give you one, but can't do that on the internet yet. But this is a book we wrote. It's a bit different to the ones that are designed to give away to Christians who've got a neighbor in a cult, yeah, or to somebody who's in a cult. So this one is really written primarily for Christian leaders. And basically, there are lots of different cults in Asia and Korea and in Korea and in the Philippines. And of course, a lot of cults come out of America. But the United States.
Really? I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like the Mormons come out of the States.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
Jehovah's Witnesses come out of the States.
Historically. Yeah,
even the Adventists come out of the States, you know. So particularly in the 1800s, when it was very, very, a very, very common thing to be telling people Jesus is coming back really soon and here's the date.
Yeah.
This one here, Current Korean Cults, we wrote it because these particular cults are such a problem in the church today. I cover the Moonies now, the Unification Church.
Yeah.
They're still out there. We don't see a lot now. They're a
small group. I didn't know that was still a thing. I thought the Moonies were back in the 90s.
Moon died in 2012.
Uh-huh.
One of his wives reckons that now she's the only begotten daughter of God, so she's basically the Messiah. But one of his sons is also vying for the leadership, and he's got an obsession with guns for some reason. But anyway, so they're not much in the picture, but the big ones are Shinjonji and the World Mission Society Church of God. So we look at them and we explain, for example, why it's important, because these people are actually targeting believers.
Yeah.
They're targeting people who don't know the church well. I know of a church, evangelical church in Auckland. The head of elders, started getting a bit strange. And she was being recruited and was effectively recruited into Shinjonji. Now, Shinjonji is led by an old bloke, around 90 odd, his name is Meehan Lee or Leehan Mee or one of those three.
Yeah.
You can actually say them in different orders, but he teaches that basically he's the return of Jesus Christ, as many of these cult leaders do. Sun Myung-moon basically said, I've come to do what Jesus failed to do. And so he's saying that the Bible has got a lot of parables and mysteries in it, and I'm the only one with the key to understanding those mysteries. Okay. And so they are planting people in churches to recruit people in those churches. It's not only them, others are doing it as well. So there's an existential threat to the people of God if their leaders don't know what's going on. How do you identify these guys? So we look at that in the book. We look at the theology of these guys. Think about these Shinjonji as they're allowed to lie or fool you about who they are. They call it the wisdom of hiding. And what we try to say to them, folks, guys, if you're allowed to tell lies, then your organization is allowed to lie to you. And but we see these guys quite often out when we're doing outreach. Sometimes it'll be a group of Shinjonji, and some of them will engage with us. And the World Mission Society Church of God is the other one. And this is from a fellow, Ah Sung Hong, from memory, as his name is. And again, a Korean. And there is something about the sociology of Korea which gives rise to people honoring and following somebody who's dressed in an American-looking suit, who's successful, who's a strong, charismatic leader. Huh. And for some reason, it just kind of fits the mold. They are a very, very religious people, and they wouldn't be surprised if the Messiah came back that he'd be born as a Korean. And some of them think that they're the 144,000. And so this guy was a Seventh-day Adventist, and he was kicked out of there. He had a woman on the side, and that woman on the side is God the Mother. So he died some time ago, but this woman is now God the Mother, and they believe God is feminine. And basically they want you to follow her, and she is still alive. And so these are bizarre things, but like all cults, they have a workspace. That one has got a lot of ritual, got to do the Old Testament stuff that they would have probably inherited from the Seventh-day Adventists, and got to pay a tithe, have the Passover, have the other rituals. So very legalistic, and of course a lot of cults put a lot of pressure on to get money. So we wrote this book because we see a need in the church, and that leaders need a wake-up call, because the possibility is that they have got somebody in their church looking for a recruit. We had a guy in our church who invited one of our youngest new believers to a Bible study at 2:30 in the morning. And we were onto him. I still don't know for sure what group he represented, but
the Bible study took place at 2:30, or the invitation came at 2:30?
No, I believe that the Bible study was to take place at 2:30.
Oh, there's a little red flag right off the bat.
Yeah, well, I would say so. You've got to be pretty spiritual to go to a Bible study at that time. So they're out there, and this is really to warn church leaders what to look for, you know, how to guard against it, and how to discuss with these people when there's opportunity, knowing the tricks that they use.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I knew of a guy that was in my previous church, and he was a he went to Auckland Uni, and he got swept away. It was, what do they call SCJ or SJC? I don't remember the initials, but it was definitely a Korean cult. I think it was the same one you're talking about. The leader's like in his 90s, and the big thing is when one of my good friends was talking to him, you know, he's not supposed to die. So if he dies, I think it's, you know, game over for that. At least it should be.
Yeah, well, it should be. They'll get around that somehow. That will be Shinjonji, and the old guy is Ali and me and Lee or whatever. They're very, very potent and out there, and a lot of young people walk into it.
Sweeping people away into it, yep. And it's gosh, nefarious. Do you, in your book, do you talk about the doctrines and where they get off theologically and doctrinally? Is that part of?
Yeah, we give a summary of their doctrines, and it's not a big book. And it's only $12 or something online. But okay. We talk about the basics of their theology and also how to recognize them. One of the problems is these groups use different names. One of them, Shinjonji, often use the word Zion. So they go to Zion Church. And so there's all sorts of names. One group can call themselves Elohists. That makes them very difficult to pin down. But it's pretty sneaky. But, you know, those guys in there are precious, but they're just deceived. That's the same with most cults, eh?
Sure.
It's the devil and it's the leaders that are the deceivers. The others, you know, they're deceived and they're not the enemy. We gotta love them and try to help them to see and understand the truth.
Yeah, and they're just nefarious. The one that I'm talking about, just they have no problem with bringing in a new recruit, and most of the people are the old guard. They're already in the cult, but they're pretending to be new. They're pretending to be curious. They're pretending, and they love bomb on the people, and just wow, it's very deceptive. And you know, they meet, you know, a basic human need of love. People want to feel loved and accepted and part of a group. And
it's interesting you should say that, Todd, because my brother-in-law's brother was one of the leading Moonies in Auckland and New Zealand. And he got married in one of these massive weddings. Mm. Nice lady. I think he'd met her once or something like that before they got married. But he said, and he was brought up in that apparently evangelical home, he said, I was looking for love. You know, there's a sense of love and belonging and community that he's got to offer. You know, I think we're going to see this as a wake-up call to the church. Yeah, are we meeting the need for community? And, of course, they're zeroing in on people who honour religious people, like Polynesians, for example. They honour pastors, you know, they put you on a bit of a pedestal. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are not well taught in the Bible, so they're very vulnerable. And these are the ones that these guys are after. So the church really, as Christian leaders, we need to recognize that we need to teach our people why they believe what they believe and make sure they've got a solid biblical faith. Then they can discern the difference when it comes along.
Yeah. And so you in the book, it's talking, it's addressing leaders. It shows the leaders how to, A, recognize them, how to, B, deal with them. Is there, you know, theologically, and then is there anything in the book on how to extract people out of these cults? Because I know that's a very difficult task. I knew one that did an actual rescue. They went and grabbed her in the middle of the night and had to reprogram her, basically, for a few weeks. Yeah.
Well, a lot of those cults, particularly that focus particularly on the States, because that's the place for cults to go because there was big money and a lot of spirituality, but not always Christianity. You know, in the old days, they would hire people to go and rescue their kids from cults, and then they had to deprogram them.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm referring to.
Yeah, that's a massive job. That's a massive job. It's better to stop them going over the cliff than to try to catch the bottom.
Prevention's better than the cure. Mm. For sure. Mm. But do you offer any suggestions for, you know, when people are steeped in that or starting to go down that road, any suggestions?
Yeah, there is some in there. I mean, this is a bit of an overview. It's not a great big thick book, okay? It's that thick, okay? So it's really, because we're finding that, like all of my books, I mean, great news for Sikhs, that's how big it is. You know, people will pay $5 for this sum anyway. And we give a lot of them out free. But people will read something that'll take an hour on the bus.
Yeah.
But expect them to take a $30 book, and the chances are it won't get read. So we're really working on an educational summary here.
Yeah.
And some of the main arguments. So it's not exhaustive, but it's I would say it's what every pastor needs to read. And so we're hoping that they'll sell okay.
Good. Would you contend that these Korean cults are one of the largest up and coming or largest threats, or just another? You know, you got your Jehovah's Witnesses and your Mormons or whatnot.
I think another. Jesus told us that in the last days, many false Christs would come. So we shouldn't be surprised by all this, really, should we?
Yeah.
And I guess we can expect more. I would say another. It's just that there's something about the sociology of Korea and the highly structuredness of their society that gives people unnatural authority over other people and lends itself to becoming having cult-like influence on them. And cults generally are a mixture of Christianity and other belief systems. And I think in Asia, you get some Asian authoritarian kind of approach to belief systems and spirituality, and it gets mixed up with Christianity. You know, for example, the Mormon Church. The Mormon Church is a mixture of Christianity, Blue Lodge Freemasonry, which is a lower level of Freemasonry because Joseph Smith was a Mason, and also straight out occult activity. And so you're getting what we call a syncretism here, a merging of belief systems. And it's interesting, you look at a lot of distortions down throughout the centuries. They are basically a mixing of Christianity with another belief system. You get the Gnostics, you know, that was Greek philosophy mixed with Christianity. And so the Apostle Paul writes Colossians. I would argue that hyper-Calvinism was a bit of a mixture of, and I'm not saying all Calvinists, you know, some of my best Calvinists are friends. But I think an extreme of that can be a mixture of the pagan Greek and Roman philosophy we call fatalism. There's three women, the Fates, who predestined everything that happens in your life. And you bring that down through Plato and then through Augustine, and who was a disciple of Augustine was John Calvin. So I suspect that there is, you know, these other philosophies can just sort of nudge Christianity in the wrong direction, and it can be the thin edge of the wedge, and then, of course, it blows up. It is well known that strong pagan influence in the early days of Roman Catholicism, when things were brought into the church and when Christianity was made the official religion of the Roman Empire, as a woman in Rome last year told me, a pagan temple has just put a cross on top and they carried on. You know, so you're getting all of these influences and you end up way off track in your theology sooner or later. And we have to be aware and say, what influences are in our society today in the world that are mixing it with Christianity and producing a distortion?
Yeah. And a lot of them are coming out of Korea then. Wow.
Some of them, yeah. Some of the major, most influential ones. Korea's got the biggest church in the world, you know, and it's got a huge, strong spirituality. A lot of wonderful people.
Sure.
A lot of Presbyterian churches over there, you know. So some good, solid theology, but then you get guys who go off track, and I think the devil enables them, and they get a big following.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I always look at people that have gone off track and stuff and think, how did you miss that? How did you get deceived? When somebody says they're Jesus, you know, come again, it just should just raise a huge red flag, but somehow the God of this world has blinded them or something. I don't know. It's a mystery.
I think it's part of it. I think it's quite funny, actually. I think it was in India or the Philippines. Last Easter, this fellow went running to the police because he was telling everybody that he was Jesus come back again.
Yeah.
And they decided to put it to the test by killing him and letting him raise himself from the dead. So he went running off to the cops to try and get some protection. So he obviously wasn't quite as convinced about his messiahship as son,
I guess,
as he led on.
It's like the Old Testament, you know, if a prophet prophesies it doesn't come to pass, they should stone them. Well, yeah. You know, yeah. Where the rubber meets the road.
But, you know, I think this is why scriptures the Bible has to be our number one commentary on the commentaries, because we don't realize, our worldview is probably a mixture of things, you know, like we've in New Zealand with materialism. We've got evolutionism for some people, and so it can happen subtly without us realizing it, and people just over a few generations can go way off track.
Yeah. Do you get pushback from, you know, let's face it, New Zealand, Western society is increasingly multicultural. You've alluded to that. But also the attitude, the, you know, kind of the key attitude is tolerance. That's our key virtue of the day. And do you get pushback from people saying, you know, you're intolerant or exclusive or narrow-minded or whatnot?
Yeah, people who want to be purists, they will give you some pushback. We don't get it. We don't get a lot of aggressive pushback, okay, to be honest, out in the streets. A lot of the aggression against Christianity is expressed on the internet these days and on,
oh, sure,
you know, what blog sites and things like that. Our most common sort of answers are, I don't believe in God, in which case I say, what comes from nothing? And because most people who claim to be atheists are actually not atheists. And then we get the pluralism of the day, which is, you know, all roads lead to Rome.
Yeah.
All religions are true.
Yeah.
And then I just explain that, you know, if Islam is true, Christianity is not true, because we believe in Christianity that Jesus is the Son of God. A Muslim, that will be a blasphemy for them. Mm-hmm. And so, and like if Hinduism is true and there's many incarnations, well, then we believe in one life and resurrection, then we can't be true. So, and when you point this out, people kind of normally get it. They drift along with this nice idea, but when you give them a wee bit of logic, I think they generally understand it. I've got this little theory that, like, we talk to a lot of Indians and Sikhs, great people, great food. And you know, in the past, Asian belief systems particularly don't have to make sense. You know, we in the West, we are the result of a Greek thinking and logic. It's very important to us. And now in India and in Asia, technology is so important and so big in the industry. Mm-hmm. You cannot have technology without understanding logic. And I think that there's an opportunity here. A lot of, you know, like young Indian people who come to New Zealand and to live here, they're a great opportunity for evangelism, because they're understanding logic. And when you look at Hinduism, it's not logical. And a lot of Asian religions are not logical. I mean, yeah. I mean, Buddhism isn't. Buddha said one of the big problems we had that keeps us reincarnating is that we believe we exist as an entity, not just part of a whole. In Hinduism, you've got the problem, and one of the things you can do is look at the cosmology of a belief system to see if it makes sense. Look at the understanding of the origin of the universe. Hinduism believes that everything is God. We're all part of God. The universe is God. The skies are God. The trees are God. So where's your cosmology? Well, that means God had to create himself.
Right.
Because if the universe is God and God's the creator, then the universe has to create itself. But you have to already exist to create anything. So it just kind of like falls down logically. And I suspect that a lot of people maybe and are being way more open spiritually now that this is such a big part of the experience of the world. Hopefully they'll let go the nonsense religions and look at the objective reality of Christianity and be open to it. And I think some are.
Do you get many people, young university students that are kind of just, you know, the postmodern, well, you have your truth and I have, everybody's got their own truth. I mean, where do you go with that?
Yeah, that's still prevalent out there. But there's two issues we can point out. And I remember having a discussion with a lady by the railway line, actually near where I live in Glenedin, and she was postmodern in her thinking, which means she believed she could have her truth, and if it was different to mine, well, that was fine, because it's all very subjective, isn't it? You become your own arbiter of truth. You become your own God, basically. It's really self-deification in a way. But I said to her, look, if I said to you, there's a train coming down this track, and we better hop off or we'll get hit by the train, and you said to me, there's no train coming down the track, I said, we can't both be right, can we?
Yeah.
She says, yes, we can. You know, I've never seen her since, and I'm wondering if she's been hit by a train. But
maybe.
because you cannot live with postmodern views
in
normal life. You need to know if that is a truck. You need to know that your truth actually lines up with reality. And I think a lot of people can see that when you explain it to them logically.
Yeah. Somehow they just do, don't they, that truth can, you can compartmentalize. Oh, yeah, when it comes to our bank accounts and our driving on the highway, yeah, there's objective truth. But when it comes to religious beliefs and stuff, we can be very subjective, and it can be like our favorite flavor of ice cream. It's very subjective.
Yes. Yes, I think so. But, you know, I think people, as you're hinting at, actually believe on two different levels. We get a lot of people who say they're an atheist, you know, and it suits them to say that. But, you know, when something goes wrong, the first thing they say is, oh, my God. They have a moral code. Where'd they get that from? And when you tease it out a little bit, you realize that, and I'm convinced that a lot of people have got way more belief in God than they would admit to you on the street. And sometimes it's just to keep you at arm's length. I'm an atheist, so don't try to convince me. They believe at different levels. You know, Romans 1 says people suppress the truth by their wickedness.
Yeah.
And they suppress it, but it has a nasty habit of popping up at times, you know? And I think this is one of the reasons why a lot of people who go by a different morality, Christians, they're really, really anti-Christian, because we remind them of a reality that's in their own heart that they're trying to suppress. Mm-hmm. We're telling them that certain things are wrong. And they know deep down, even though they want to pursue some of these, the whole gay lifestyle is a classic example of that.
Yeah, I'm sure. Do you get a lot of pushback on the streets about you know, God's sexual ethic, morality?
Sometimes. Some people will ask you what you think. And we kind of train our people, our volunteers and our chaplains, to be very wise. You've got to see what's behind the question. Mm-hmm. And a lot, if they're just trying to cause trouble, you can just say, look, if you want to know the answer, just go and ask God, okay?
Do you actually say that?
Sometimes. Certainly happy to do that. But then others are asking a question because they genuinely want to know. And you've got to come across as God's loving representative in that situation. Sometimes we often get pushback by people who are hurt. They've been ripped, you know, they've been abused by somebody in the church, or life has turned sour for them, and it's all God's fault, of course.
Sure.
And those are the ones where there's a wound that you often get a lot of passion. And you've got to be wise about how to deal with it. You've got to not argue with them, but just say, tell me your story and listen. With our chaplain training, one of the biggest things we try to help people to understand is the incredible importance of listening. And even praying for people who they may not agree with you, but very rarely will people say no if you say, do you mind if I pray for you now?
Yeah.
Please keep your eyes open.
Yeah. Wow. How many days a week are you out there, Auckland Uni or in the CBD or wherever you go?
We will be at the CBD. In Auckland, tomorrow's Friday. It's our main day for street work. But we also do some. Yesterday I was out near Lynmore. There were three of us and with our table, and we had some amazing conversations. And of course, the high school students arrive and they all want the chocolate. They're all willing to do the survey.
But they actually they allow you to be at the mall because it is private property, right?
Yeah. No, we're not at the mall. We're near the entrance to the mall on the public property.
Public property.
Yeah, you're going to have permission to get it in the mall.
I'm sure.
Yeah, it suits us better just to be freedom. We have tomorrow there'll be an outreach team in the Waikato that I quite often go and join with those guys in the public area near the council buildings. Tomorrow we'll be down outside this outside Britomart by McDonald's there. And, you know, we get a lot of Christians come along, and they're really encouraged to see us there as well, and we have some good yarns with them. It's not only the pagan unbelievers that you're ministering to. You also have the opportunity to encourage believers on their journey. So we do that, and we're often involved with markets and camps and the holidays. And so, but generally Wednesday and Friday, and then there's preparation for preaching on the weekends and things like that. Right. And I, of course, spend some time writing as well.
Yeah. Do you still do any of your youth camp work or work with, you know, that kind of stuff? High school people?
Yeah, I do when I'm invited to speak.
Yeah.
But I'm older than you, I think, Todd. I know you do a lot of that ministry. I stand in awe of you, all the stuff that you manage to do. And but if I get an invitation and it works and it suits, we will, I'm very happy to go and, because I've still got the old gear and I've still got the sketchboard and I understand the gospel. Yeah. And you can be old, you know, but kids will listen to you, partly because the grandfather thing image still works with kids, maybe not teenagers. But also if you love the kids and the kids know you care about them, they'll listen to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, authenticity is important.
Yeah.
And so, and Ian, what we do, if I'm speaking at a camp, an evangelistic camp, I will start at my first talk will be something about creation, and then I build, because I'm working through the belief system, help them to understand creation. Same with our beach missions. We go 6-day beach missions. We start at creation. We deal with the fall and sin. We explain about who Jesus is, his death, his resurrection. Yep. And then the next day we explain about making a decision to follow Jesus. We give an invitation to them to respond.
Yeah.
And then the last day we're normally about, okay, here are the keys to growing in your friendship with God. So we always want to start at the foundations and build up, because today they don't understand the foundations, you know.
Yeah.
And we do see responses, not as many, you know. 25 years ago when I would speak at run a program in a motor camp over summer, our beach mission, we would expect quite a number of people to respond to Christ, particularly kids. Mm-hmm. It seems to be less so now, but we do see some. But it's actually training of our leaders and them experiencing evangelism, which is part of the part of the most. We're training people to be leaders in the Christian community, really, and to be evangelistic.
Why do you think it is that there's less response to the gospel, the gospel invitations these days? What's changed?
Well, what's changed is, I think, as Billy Graham put it, that we live in an unseeded generation. In the past, if you go way back, most kids in New Zealand went to Sunday school. You know, their parents didn't all, but way more people went to church. Almost every school had Bible in schools. Now, there are still some, but they do a great work, but their work is mainly laying the foundations. You can't really do evangelism in that situation at school.
Right.
A lot of their parents are bought into evolution. They're being brought up with books on dinosaurs when they're 4, and it takes an evolutionary perspective, although I'm convinced that the whole evolutionary paradigm is dead and gone now, but people will hold on to it because the only other belief system in town is creation.
Right.
So I think there's a whole variety of things. And also, way more kids that come from immigrant families who aren't Christians. And it's not politically correct these days to have prayer in schools, although with Māoridom, if you call it a karakia, it's okay, you know?
Yeah.
So I think the society has become more secular. Mm. And even some churches adapting to that by offering you a better secular life if you become a Christian, you know, the whole prosperity.
Stress life now. That kind of stuff. I guess I'm blessed in that because, as you know, I do kids camps down at Raglan with Children's Bible Ministries. And because we get to have these young people for a full week, we can just submerge them in Christianity, the Christian worldview, the Christian culture, the Christian lifestyle. And we do see, you know, usually about 20 or so come to know the Lord per camp.
Yep.
And it's just great.
Yep.
We love it.
Yep.
You know, it wasn't until I came to New Zealand in 2003, I landed here 4 to live, but doing some door-to-door evangelism here in the North Shore of Auckland was the first time I'd ever met anybody that had never heard the name of Jesus. Now, of course, they were from Asia, but it was just so foreign to me because, like you say, I guess I was dyed in the wool as an American, just it's a Christian nation, if you will. So it was strange. Huh? You must come across that a lot, you know, in Auckland and the CBD.
Yeah, you know, New Zealand is one of the hardest mission fields, yeah, I reckon. It's changing because of immigration and things like this, but
yeah,
European New Zealanders are generally reasonably wealthy and reasonably comfortable. They don't sense their need of Christ until the cracks open in their lives, you know. Mm-hmm. Marriage breaks up, somebody dies in the family. And I believe that if we are wise about it, when the cracks open, that's when the light can get in.
Sure.
So we need to continue to connect with them and continue to do all the gospel foundation stuff.
Yeah.
I still think there's a place for mass evangelism. I love it when I remember Billy Graham coming, the other great evangelists. It brings the church together, and it's a great testimony. But the bottom line is that we can't depend on that kind of evangelism in New Zealand today to do the job. We need everybody to be a community chaplain, if you like, everybody to be engaging with their neighbors.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like one of the apologists says, we don't need $1 million apologists. We need $1 million apologists there, you know,
yeah.
which kind of makes sense. Yeah. Well, let's see. So we've gone through the book a bit, which is the main thing. Are there any, what was I going to say? Are there any contemporary atheists out there that get brought up a lot, Alex O'Connell, for instance, or anybody, or, you know, that people tend to point to, or you tend to, it gives you pause, or, you know, you have to wrestle with their arguments?
I think really just out in society, Richard Dawkins is probably the one most people know.
Yeah.
and could say the name. Your hoi polloi public are not really up on the philosophical debates and side of things. So those of us who are apologists and that we know these names and know where they're coming from and things like that. But the only one that I would hear reasonably regularly is Richard Dawkins, who's really the apostle, the high apostle of evolution. But
yeah,
he apparently acknowledges that there may be a God. Well, that's nice of him, isn't it? And again, I think he believes more than he lets on.
Probably so. I know he's yearning for a Christian culture without Christ, isn't he?
He is. And one of the reasons for that is because what he would see is the downside of the growth of Islam in the United Kingdom. And so watch this space. It's funny, isn't it? They don't recognize often that they're biting the hand that feeds them. When they speak out against Christ, sure. Because our culture, you know, in New Zealand, people are wanting to return to ethnic gods, and I'm planning a book about the difference between Jesus and the ethnic gods. But those ethnic gods, I mean, they didn't keep us horrible colonials away, so they're pretty useless, really. But they don't realize that it's, all of the benefits that we share in New Zealand, or a lot of them, actually come from Christianity. And our legal system is still based largely on the Bible, or a lot of it. Obvious areas where it's not now, but it certainly has been. And so that's what's made New Zealand a great place to live, and why so many people around the world want to move from countries with other belief systems and come to our country with our belief system. Yeah.
Do you find there's a lot of Muslims that you come across, and are they willing to dialogue and engage in, you know, conversations?
We run into Muslims all the time. Very, very rarely will we do an outreach and we don't have a Muslim. And the younger generations of Muslims are quite happy to talk. It's like they're in a culture that isn't so controlling as slick, you know, like Pakistan or Afghanistan or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've come in where they're allowed to think and they're allowed to talk. And it's funny, you get the whole variety. You just get lovely people who've got lovely kids and they want to bring up their kids well, and they want to be in a safe community, and they want to have their faith, but they're not radical Islamists, mm-hmm. so they just kind of ignore that part of their scriptures and stuff.
All right.
And then you've got the other ones that are, you know, we've got this young fellow who comes along sometimes when we're just in New Linlea, and he's strong and determined to convert us to Islam because it's the only true religion.
Yeah.
So you get the whole gamut, but and not normally people like him. They're normally polite. They don't normally argue much with you. And I give them a copy of my little book, Great News for Muslims, which is very gentle, but it explains for Muslims what Christians believe and why, because they've got all sorts of weird ideas about what Christians yeah, believe.
That's for sure.
But it also explains to Christians what Muslims believe. And so in New Zealand, they're very, very open to think. And however, for a Muslim to leave their faith is a massive thing. You know, if somebody leaves the Christian faith and becomes a Mormon or a Jehovah's Witness, you know, their family will probably, we'd rather not, but it's just their thing.
Yeah.
But for a Muslim family where one of their kids leaves Islam, It's a disgrace to the whole family, because it's an honor shame sort of society that they're familiar with. And so if your child has left the Islamic faith and become a Christian, that is a great shame on your family. So there's a lot of internal resistance going on in that community for people not to be converted. But then you don't read about it in the news much, but you've got millions of Muslims coming to Christ and rejecting some of the key tenets of Islam, but you don't hear about that on the news media.
No, I'm sure.
But look at Iran; the church correct. Has been growing. Huh?
It's not politically correct to do that,
No.
Proselytize and that.
Mm. No. So,
You're saying in Iran that the growing church there, Christian church.
Yeah, I mean the church has been growing faster than anywhere else in the world in Iran in the last few years, apparently. So, but you don't see that on the world.
Haven't heard it, no.
But, you know, any cult or religion, the first key is to show love. And I think for the average Christian who wants to be a faith sharer, you want to show love to your Muslim neighbors. You want to, take some food over, make sure it's halal, and make sure it's not alcohol, or make sure it's not ham, or anything like that,
yeah.
But you want to get to know them, and then on the basis of that, you want to share the difference. So I say to people, sharing the gospel with a cultist is like you put your arm around them first, not necessarily literally. Yeah. I got to be careful with that these days.
Sure,
but you put your arm around them, and then you build the relationship, and then you quietly slip the knife in later, because once you've established that relationship, and you can say, well, now let's talk about what our faiths have in common. Now let's talk about the differences, and that's where you can move. But because with a lot of people, it's not so much going to happen cold turkey on the street,
right?
It's going to happen by loving neighbors, sharing with neighbors,
gradual thing,
who are noticing. So evangelism, as always, I guess, but particularly today, needs to be backed up by an evangelistic lifestyle, but also the articulation of the message. And there's such great resources out there to help us now too.
Yeah. You know, I guess a question I probably should have asked right up front, and maybe we can edit this, and is for you, how do you define a cult? Because it seems like there's a range of a cult that is, obviously not Christian, but might call themselves that. Is that where you define a cult? Somebody, a group that calls themselves Christians, but don't adhere to the fundamental tenets of the Christian faith.
Yeah.
There are certainly Christian churches around us that are very controlling and could be called cultish. So where do you draw a line, Lou? What's your definition that you're using for cults, Korean cults?
Well, I think first of all, I think we draw a distinction between world religions, like the key ones, uh-huh. Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Sikhism, and a cult is what I would call a pseudo-Christian cult. So it claims to be Christian, but it's moved so far away from the truth, it's now false or pseudo-Christian. Now, there are some characteristics to look for to decide whether they're a cult or whether at the moment a bit of a sect, but they haven't gone into cult zone. I mean, every religion has its cults. Like a lot of Muslims would believe that if they're Sunni, Shiites are a cult, you know. So it means a group that's strayed away from the core teachings of the religion. The first one would be, I would identify a cult is that they will often change the fundamental belief about God, who he is. For example, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints believe that God is a man with a body living on the planet, near the starbase Kolob with many wives. That's the Heavenly Father for them. So they've gone way off what the Bible teaches about the fundamentals of who God is. The cults will also distort Jesus. Okay, so the Jehovah's Witnesses believe that Jesus is the Archangel Michael, a created spirit being. Mormons believe that Jesus is the brother to Lucifer. He is one of many gods. And then you've got the Jehovah's Witnesses, or has talked about them, but there are other groups like Christadelphians that don't believe in the deity of Christ other. And so it's what they do with the Father, it's what they do with Jesus, and it's particularly what they do with the doctrine of salvation. Every cult will have some element of works in their teaching. They cannot afford to let you believe that you are saved by grace through faith alone, because they lose their control. They can't say to you, you've got to do what we say or you'll go to hell. You know, because I could say, no, I'm already on the way to heaven and I've got my passport. It's Christ. So they will always monkey with the doctrine of salvation. And it might be a process that is a mixture of faith and works. Like Roman Catholicism is a process, they would. So sooner or later, they're going to believe that works, your spiritual performance, is how you earn or hold your salvation.
Yeah.
And the other thing is the hierarchical leadership. Most cults have got a leadership, you know. And Jesus forbade his people to have a hierarchy and to have titles. And we see it a lot in the Christian church. I've got in mind a book once called The Church's Favorite Disobedience. Because when you've got a hierarchical, it might be good, you might feel it's good for your ego, you're climbing the ladder. But Jesus said, no, you're all brothers. And you've got to lead by serving. And this sort of cult plays, that sort of structure plays into the darker side of human nature and all the politics. You look at some of the politics that goes on in church and in various denominations and different ethnicities. Yeah. And so it's not what defines a cult, but you see it in a lot of cults. The Jehovah's Witnesses, they had two leaders like that, but then they got a committee because things had gone a bit wrong. So that's a characteristic, but the core things are, on what basis are we made right with God?
Yeah.
And who is Jesus?
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. Well, that helps distinguish. So it's the nature of God, the Father, the nature of who Jesus is, and soteriology, how we're saved.
That's right. And they will also often not believe in the bodily resurrection of Christ. And that's where we smell a rat when we see a group. There's a group in all around the country now, a church group, and I think you've got to understand some more sociological things about that. But where one of the leaders said, or their leader said, seemed to say that Jesus didn't raise bodily from the dead, and it created a big storm among us cult watchers, and And then they quickly withdrew, backed off that particular doctrine. So for most cults, like Jehovah's Witnesses, they believe that Jesus's body was dissolved into gases in the tomb, and he made these appearances, but they were basically fake appearances, to convince people that he was alive. So they don't believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus. So you'll often see that as well. And then you've got sects that are way out legalistic, you know, and like, for example, the Exclusive Brethren. I know a lot about them because my background is in the Open Brethren.
Okay.
Would I call them a cult? They believe in the deity of Christ. They believe in in salvation by grace through faith, I think. But, you know, they are so loaded down with rules and regulations that have nothing to do with the Bible. And it's all about control. So I ask the question, are they a cult or are they a sect? Well, they might be what we call a sect, but there's a bit of a fuzzy line
there. Yeah, sure.
You know,
no demarcation. I get it.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Lou, are there any questions or topics that you were hoping that I would answer that you kind of wanted to delve into for a second, or have we covered kind of a nice gamut that you're satisfied with?
I'm satisfied. One of the core things that I think that we need to continue to emphasize is evidence for God and design and creation.
Yeah,
because in the end, that's the key point. And I agree that the argument for design is winnable, you know, for reasonably thinking people. Now, I know that not all believers want to line up with the 6-day young earth creation.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe in that situation, there's two interfaces. There's my interface with the unbelieving community. And I never would talk about how old the earth is. I don't know for 100% sure myself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the key place to start. That's not the key place to start. The key place to start is, are we designed? Because if we're designed,
sure,
we are owned by our designer, and he has got the right to be Lord of our lives. So the whole foundation of the gospel is creation. It gives God the right to say that we should submit to him as Lord. And we, as we know, becoming a Christian is submitting to Jesus as Lord and trusting in what Christ has done for us on the cross. So I think we have to remember that we've got to get that box ticked first, and then we move on to talk about sin. Because once you understand the holiness of God, then sin becomes way more sinful. And I think one of the problems in the church today is that we emphasize the love of God, which we should. It's core of his being. God is love, but we don't always emphasize the holiness of God, and people have lost what it means to tremble in the presence of God and to sense the fear of God. As believers, we don't. That doesn't have to be a terror, but a deep, awesome respect of God. And if you don't have that, you've got to ask the question: well, is the genuine gospel being preached? Are people actually repenting of their false gods and their sinfulness?
Sure.
And are they putting Christ in jail? Or are they having a utilitarian approach to God? I'll take the bits I like.
Yeah.
But that's not what a disciple is. A disciple takes the bits that their master wants them to have.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to keep these things in perspective. But, you know, there does seem to be an upswelling of interest in Christianity. The world system's obviously not working for people.
Right.
Our modern life is getting way more anxious for young people. And we hope and pray that they're realizing something is seriously missing and that they'll start a journey.
Yeah. Amen to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, that's a little bit. But I love apologetics, and I love what you guys are doing, because it's so critical. The moment you share the gospel with somebody, they've got questions, you know, and that's where apologetics comes in, answering the questions, removing the stumbling blocks on the way to Christ. Very so critical in the modern world. Yeah.
Passionate about it. Well, one thing that I asked you all, the guests that I have on my show is what waters your soul the most as a Christian? You know, what spiritual discipline or habit kind of has the greatest impact and keeps your Christian life fresh and not stale or stagnant or whatever?
That's a bit of a tough question, because in reality, I quite often feel that my Christian life is getting a bit stagnant. And one of the reason is you can get so busy in service for the Lord that you don't develop that quality time with the Lord. But for me, I mean, my wife and I have devotions over a cup of tea before we get up, which is great. But then I go, and not as regularly as I should, and I just read the scriptures. And I've got this little thing where I take my shoes off because it's holy ground spend some time with the Lord. But I'm so easily distracted. But the other thing that really rings my bell is when I see young people growing in their faith and getting exciting about evangelism and serving Christ and developing. One of the favorite things I lecture at is a camp called Lake Learning. Uh-huh. And it's at Lake Taupo, it's at my camp. We started off, a bunch of us lecturers, we started off 10 years ago with about a half a dozen students. Uh-huh. And basically they get 30 lectures a week, okay, and during the week plus plenary sessions. So it's like an intensive Bible school. If they come in the first year, they'll get 6 from me on evangelism and 6 from 4 other lecturers. If they come back again, they get 6 from me on apologetics. If they come back again, they get 6 from me on cults and religions. And we have to keep reinventing year 5 because people have been 8 times.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, I just about wept because we started off with half a dozen. We've worked hard on it. We get guys that are dynamic, you know, good communicators. And on the first night, there were 90 young people praising God and looking forward to a week of solid Bible teaching.
Oh,
and, you know, and some of them meet wives there as well, we've noticed. And so there's other spin-offs. But uh-huh. that spins my wheels, because these guys are wanting to be missionaries. They're wanting to take Christ seriously.
Yeah.
They're wanting to be disciples. The thing that doesn't spin my wheels is admin, but fortunately I've got a wife who's a very good administrator.
That's good. You're married into your strength and your weakness. Oh, awesome. Well, Lou, thanks so much for just sharing a bit of your ministry and what you do and how you do it, and just helping to equip the body here in New Zealand. Appreciate that. Very practical stuff that you put out there. Just if people want to find out more about your stuff, is there a website? Where would you direct them to?
Sure. So it's www.lifequestresources. 3 words jammed together as we do. lifequestresources.co.nz. So they can have a look online there. It's got our resources. They can order them. If they're an evangelist and using heaps and heaps, they just need to email us, because we try to get it as close to cost as we can for people who are using a lot of these materials.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, have a look.
Cool.
Good.
All right. Well, thanks again, Lou. I appreciate you being here with me today. And for you listeners, people that are watching and listening, make sure you subscribe to the Thinking Matters podcast, where you'll hear more interesting and equipping interviews like we did with Lou today. Hope to see you next time.
For more reasons why we believe,
or to support this ministry, go to
thinkingmatters.org.nz.